we're going to start. Yep. We're going to do some colon. We're overkill on this one, so to speak, on one issue. Yes. We're going to cover some of this stuff next week. Okay, let's go. Yes, I want to do wherever, whenever people engage in the divine word, the divine presence abides among them. Oh, I found what I wanted, what I was looking for earlier. It's on the, probably on the back of that page, the prophetic call.
Did it so well at home.
This is the call. And before you go, let's see. You don't have the whole thing, but. You got them, unfortunately. It's quite nice then. That's the most important place to this one, so. Okay, so you learned about Hadith, right? So what is Hadith?
Traditions
about the Prophet. Yeah, traditions about the Prophet. And what is Sunnah?
Behavior.
So what's the difference between
Sunnah? Behavior of the Prophet.
What's the difference between Sunnah and Hadith?
I think Sunnah is from Aisha? No.
No.
Sunnah is more about what she did. Sunnah, how do you get more things that she said, right?
Well, Sunnah and Hadith overlap. Sunnah is the behavior of the Prophet and his statements. It's almost an abstract term. What he said and did is his Sunnah. Mm-hmm. The Hadith is the record of what he said and did, the record of his Sunnah. So, Sunnah is a very old term that predates Islam by a lot. In pre-Islamic Arabia, since there was no legal tradition, so there were no laws, no universal systems that applied to people, no magistrates and courts and no police department or army to enforce the rule of law, all of behavior was custom. And custom was determined, basically like custom is determined everywhere, it's just culture, right? But it is officially sanctioned by Sunnah. And the Sunnah is the behaviors of the sheikh, the sheikh, or the old person, the man, usually, of the tribe who has a Sunnah. And it's that person's behaviors and statements that are emulated by the people of the tribe. Because he sort of represents the most authoritative or the best among equals is the sheikh. And the word sheikh means old man. And the sheikha is an old woman. That's really what it means. So, still retains the notion that an elder has, you know, respect and knowledge and wisdom. So that's the Sunnah. Now, when Muhammad became a leader, his Sunnah became important. If he was just a person in Arabia, basically, everybody in theory has a Sunnah, right? Because there's things, your behavior and the way you act. But it's unimportant. It's not, nobody remarks about it. But when you become a leader and an important person, your Sunnah becomes important. So when Muhammad was the leader of the Muslim people and he had close companions who were also wise and active, and they all had Sunnah. So Muhammad had Sunnah, his closest companions Abu Bakr and Omar had Sunnah as well. And it was up to the believers, the followers, to follow the sunnah of the Prophet and the greatest companions of the Prophet. So that was important, obviously for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is because when you have no more revelation anymore, and God can't keep updating you on what you're supposed to be doing or practicing or behaving, then you follow the sunnah of your leader. So they followed the sunnah of the living caliphs. But the living caliphs did things that were different from what people remember that the Prophet did. Not because they were trying to counter what he did, but because everybody's different and they can't, you know, everybody is unique. So there were conflicts between the sunnah of Muhammad and the sunnah of Abu Bakr and the other great companions of the Prophet. So it was, when that happened, what do you do? Well, you really should be following the Prophet, because presumably the Prophet is more divinely directed than the others. So they rejected the sunnah of the non-prophetic, so non-prophetic sunnah. So the sunnah, the official sunnah in Islam, is called a sunnah an-nabawiyyah, which means the
sunnah of the Prophet.
Yeah, the prophetic sunnah. And so when you read it, you'll sometimes see a sunnah an-nabawiyyah. This, you know, it's the prophetic sunnah. And that is recorded, that was just around. That was, forget about what I just said about recording. It's just there, right? So you want to know, it doesn't say in the Quran how often you should pray. It says a lot about prayer. It says you should bow and you should prostrate yourself and you should stand. And it says there's a middle prayer, but it doesn't say when they all are. It doesn't say how many there are. So how are you going to know what to do in order to be Yotze, the Yedei Chovatcha, in the Islamic tradition? And they have the same notion that we are, that you have to be Yotze. So they followed the sunnah of the Prophet. How do they know the sunnah of the Prophet? Somebody said, this is what the Prophet did. Yeah. So somebody said, the Prophet, when the Prophet stood, he stood with his hands down. Somebody said, when the Prophet stood, he stood with his hands crossed and his chest. So who are you going to follow? Which one should you do it? Which way are you going to do it? Well, you have to find out whose recitation or whose articulation of the sunnah is the most accurate. So, well, who did you hear it from? Well, I heard it from my father, who was a companion of Muhammad. And so he was there, was with him, so he saw it all the time. Well, that sounds good, I'll take it. But someone else says, well, I heard it this way, and I heard it from Aisha, the wife of the Prophet. So, oh, that's better, because she would know more than just somebody who was hanging around. So I'll accept Aisha's version of the story. So you get two different versions. So one is Shiite, and one is Sunni. Right. So they're different traditions, and they're different based on different sunnahs. So there ended up being different sunnahs. And how do you determine what sunnah is good? I mean, well, actually, let me move to a different direction. So then they had to decide what happens if, I don't know, you can make up all kinds of things. How do you pray in a certain situation? Or what do you do when you're offered food and you're not sure if it's kosher? Or what do you do in this case, in that case? And they developed lots and lots of different opinions, all based on what the Prophet did or what the Prophet said. And it became pretty clear after there were hundreds, and then thousands, and then tens of thousands, and then literally hundreds of thousands of different statements all attributed to the Prophet, people started getting wise and realizing that they were making them up. And they were making them up, some of them because they were sort of extrapolating and trying to do the best they could. And sometimes they were making them up because somebody was really pissed off at somebody else. They had a big argument. They didn't like them. They didn't want to do it their way, and they wanted to do it their way. Or they had a tradition in their family, and there was no authority for it, but that was the way they remembered doing it, and that was the way that was therefore right to them, and so they made up a tradition to support it. Well, after a while, it really got out of hand, and so we're talking about now 100 years after the death of the Prophet, when there was time to make up thousands and thousands of these things. So people began collecting them and sifting through them and trying to determine ones were accurate and which ones were not accurate. Did I already write this all in the book?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so yeah, maybe this is boring to you. Okay,
no,
maybe
I should. It's
a repetition,
yes.
So they did, and they developed a kind of methodology of analysis, and they based it mostly on the chain of transmission more than the actual statement itself. If the statement was really absurd, like Muhammad said that you should believe that Christ is one of three, the Spirit, you know, the Son, the Father, and the Holy Spirit, then that's pretty unlikely that he would have said that. So that would have been kicked out. But more likely, more often, there were real possibilities, a number of different possibilities that Muhammad could have said, and any of them are quite possibly, even if some might have been a little bit odd. So they would judge whether it was authentic based on the chain of transmission. And that's isnad criticism. So the word isnad is the chain of transmission. It doesn't have a cognate in Hebrew. But it is b'shem umro, and you have to follow. So if the person claims to have received his tradition orally from someone, and they do the research on the biographies of these two people, and they found that somebody lived in Morocco, another person lived in Syria, and they never traveled, then it was unlikely that they could have talked to one another, and so that was impossible. They would throw out that chain. People were also creating chains of transmission in order to authenticate their traditions. They were creating chains of transmission. Sometimes they worked out well, and sometimes there were weaknesses in the chain of transmission. Or somebody heard it from his uncle, but it's unlikely that the uncle was still living when the person would have heard it, would have been old enough to make sense of it, and so they would say that's a weak chain of transmission. And so the chains of transmission were evaluated as being like immaculate, strong, pretty good, yeah, not so great, actually pretty weak or terrible, and all these different levels.
And what did they do when they didn't agree?
If they
make it sound as if it's all very objective.
Yeah. No. But you mean didn't agree on the chain of transmission?
Yeah.
Oh no, they would, the scholar, you had to agree on the chain of transmission. If it was a strong chain, everybody had to agree, because
okay,
everybody knew that so-and-so really did speak to so-and-so, mm-hmm, and so it had to be a possibility. So you would say that's a strong tradition. You may a strong chain of transmission. You may have the same chain of transmission, however, in which there are two somewhat different statements on the same topic. And then you have a problem. And then you get into secondary and tertiary criteria that is used. I don't understand how they did all that. But the net result in the Sunni world was that four collections of hadiths were collected and basically canonized into a tradition, or into a collection, a library, four different books. Each book was made up of many smaller books, and it could be a serious library shelf of hadiths. And those are called the four canonical hadiths of the Sunni tradition. And the two most important ones are by a guy named Muslim and a guy named Bukhari, al-Bukhari. So the best are al-Bukhari and Muslim. And about at least half of them in the two collections are the same, because these are two separate individuals who collected many of the same traditions. And so many of the traditions are organized, are repeated also in these, under different categories, because they fit different categories. I don't know if this is even interesting to you, but the earliest collections of these were organized around the transmitters, around the names of the people who transmitted the traditions. That was the logical way to do it. But it was hard to work with, because they were random. Mm-hmm. All these different topics that were organized just around the name of somebody. So the second system of classification was to not worry about organizing around the names of transmitters, although you keep the names of transmitters in there. Instead, you organize them around the topic. and that's the system. So that's the way we have it today.
What happened to the 200, 300
that
were kicked out? Were they
kids
or were they
thrown
away?
I have a CD roll
somewhere. There are lots of collections. There are a lot of collections of hadith that are not canonical that are out there. So there are four, and each one of the four has thousands in it. And in the Shia tradition, there are two collections of canonical hadith. And most of the hadith, I don't know if it's most, but many, maybe most, I don't remember. Many of the hadith are exactly the same between them. But there are some critical differences. Many of those critical differences are associated with the authority of leadership, because that was the issue that divided the Shia from the Sunnis. And the key issue was, did Muhammad, in a particular incident in his history, designate Ali to be his heir or a successor? And both the Sunnis and the Shia agree that the incident occurred, and they agree where it happened, and they agree when it happened, and they disagree over the language that was used in the statement or the proclamation. One of them, the Sunnis, basically say, you should like Ali, he's a pretty good guy. And the Shia said, you should designate Ali, I hereby designate Ali to be my successor, or something like that. So it's vague enough that they agree on, but they don't agree on the key issue. And there are other differences as well, like on the issue of prayer, because there's differences between Sunni and Shia prayer. But there are also differences between different madhahib. A madhab is a school, a legal school. And there are four legal schools in the Muslim world. Each legal school is somewhat different, but the differences are about as significant as the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardi law. Not terribly different, but enough to irk people. Mm-hmm. And you either follow one or you follow the other. And that also deals with the choreography of prayer. There's a slight difference between like a Maliki or a Hanafi school of prayer on how you pray, and stuff like that. So most of the differences are over something else. So I just want to take out. I'm driving you crazy, right, on this one. But for day three, the five pillars of Islam. How do you like that? If you look at the last, not the last page. Yeah, the last page, page 7. We may come back to this, but this is the sources of authority in Islam. Mm-hmm. The primary source of authority for deriving law, or halakha, in Islam is the Quran. And the second one is the Sunnah. Those are agreed upon by everybody. Then there's personal opinion, analogical reasoning, and reasoned opinion. And then the fourth one is consensus. Like, if everybody agrees that this is the way it is, then this must be the way it is. What I really wanted to get to is
that within the personal opinion is from an individual or from any individual?
Oh, a scholar. It has to be a scholar. No, not any individual. Heaven forbid. You've got to have people who really know the traditions that do this. You can't just, as a plea.
That's like you follow number one or you follow number two. That this already divides you up in the direction.
Yeah, but the personal opinion issue is really an issue among scholars. It was only the personal opinion of scholars. If you lived in Tunisia, that's a Maliki school, and so you would just you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It's all laid out for you by the time when you're a Muslim in after the 9th century or 10th century.
What's the first word in Arabic?
Quran.
Sunnah.
Sunnah.
The Sunnah. What's the other one?
Hadith. Yeah. So what I really wanted to get down to is this fivefold taxonomy of conduct in Islamic law. You see this? Now, whereas in the Jewish system, you really have hayav or asur. Those are the two categories. And then everything else is sort of like whatever. Well, this, that's for something else. You have for behavior, there's no b'diavad. B'diavad is like when you are... Oh, you mean like, it may be asur, but then if you already did it, then you... don't kill the person, let's say.
You shouldn't have done that. But if you did it, it's not being able to work.
Yeah, but you do have a... You shouldn't have done it. It's asur. It becomes asur.
Yeah. Okay.
It's asur. They don't say it's better if you don't.
But is there no difference between muta and chayav? Yes.
No. Muta is no asur. In asur.
No.
It depends on what layer you're dealing with. Okay, trust me on this for a moment. Then we'll get back. We'll deconstruct it, okay? But just trust me. The way it works today is there's chayav, there's asur, and then there's everything else. It's not chayav and it's not asur. You just, you know, sitting at a table and talking is not chayav and it's not asur. It depends on who you're talking about.
What you're talking about.
In Islam, it doesn't work that way. In Islam, there is hayab, and there's asur, and then there's recommended. You really should do it, but you're not obligated. I have to do it. Or you really shouldn't do it, but it's not asur. Mm-hmm. And then there's permitted, which is just, that's the same as mutar. Mm-hmm. Right? So there are five layers. Now, it turns out that in the Talmud there were five layers, essentially, as well, but it didn't become the way to do business. It didn't become canonical. So therefore, you have, it's really asur, but b'diavad, it's not as asur as something else is asur, but it's still, the categories really are asur and chayav, right? And then everything else in between. It still is that way, although it then becomes finessed a little bit. But formally, it's chayav and asur.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. We have this in the response committee a couple of years ago, in a response on liver transplant from a live donor, where there was a question, you can do it, but it's dangerous. So what degree do we put on this? Is it chayav, or is it something which is permitted, or is it something which you may know better not, but it's not forbidden, or you say it's so dangerous that it should be us? You know, there was a whole
same kind of thing.
Like this.
Right.
So you came back.
Right. So yeah, you have, it is a problem because how do you do this? So Islam is a little bit more nuanced, I guess you would say, than Judaism in the final analysis. Now, four schools of law in the Muslim world, they basically agree on everything that is commanded. Is either commanded or is commended. The difference will not be that one thing is commanded and one thing is forbidden. You know, they'll all say this is what you should be doing. Some will say that's in the category of chayav, and the other one will say that's in the category of mishubach. It's a good thing to do. You really should be doing it, but you aren't absolutely required to do it, right? Or on the other end of the spectrum, it's asur, haram. Or it's makruh, it's condemned. You shouldn't really do it, but if you do it, you're not going to get in trouble for it. So that's the major differences between the four schools of law. They're not substantially different, you know. And that's something that you would say, like, also in, maybe in...
I don't quite get it. I mean, everybody in the four school agrees about what is commanded?
They agree that an action is, you should do.
Yeah.
Some people say, one school says you should do it, it's so important that you do it that you're obligated to do it.
Okay.
And another school would say it's important that you do it, but you're not absolutely obligated.
Okay.
You don't sin if you don't do it.
And it's also a bit flexible in between schools? Or that's clear? Everyone agrees on that?
I don't use the term haram. Use the term you shouldn't do it. Use it. Okay, use in
so
English.
So it's similar.
Similar. It's the same thing. Yeah. It could be makru. Makru means hated. It's something that's really despised, but not forbidden. Despised by the leaders of the school, but it's not forbidden.
So these are not Quranic terms. These are legal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Except but there are probably things in the Quran that say haram, right?
Yes, there are things that are haram.
So there are some that is okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You said in the Talmud there are also some things parallel to this that never really fully developed.
Yeah. These other terms, Mishubach and Mibune, for example.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't say Harei Zehayav.
Right.
So it's the same idea.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't catch on for some reason. I don't have any idea. I mean, I'm not a legal scholar. I don't know the details for any of these things. So when we were talking about the schools of law, that's why I brought that to you. So we will deal with those tomorrow when we come back together. So don't lose that entirely. Stay tuned. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't remember what else was on that. Kashrut. So.
Can I ask the Surah 5? Does it actually say Torah? Underneath page 7?
Yeah, it does say Torah.
You say Torah?
Yeah. Torah. Remember we said Torah. Torah. Inna anzalna a Torah fiha hudan wa nuran. We have sent down the Torah in which is guidance and light. Nur. Nuran. That's a name too, Nur.
Kohinur.
Yeah. Kohinur. Yeah.
This is a good sentence to replace Zohar Torah.
Yeah, but look at this is really interesting. Yeah, Torah, but you don't pronounce it. Look at that. The prophets who submitted judged the Jews by it, and the rabbis and the scholars by what they knew of the Book of God. So, and he just for. The Jews are called Aladina Hadu. They're not called. They're one of the terms in the Quran is Yahud, mm-hmm. which is obvious. But Aladina Hadu means those who have Judaized, suggesting that scholars think that what that means is that this is referring to Arabs who Judaized, who became Jews. Mm-hmm. So that the Jewish community of Arabia at the time were ethnic Arabs primarily, who became attracted to Judaism and became Jewish. Mm-hmm. So the Jews in the Quran are called Yahud, and those who have Judaized. Then there is another category of people in the Quran called Banu Israel. And that doesn't refer to Jews per se, it really refers to the biblical Israelites. And they're usually embedded in stories, you know, biblical stories, like the Bnei Israel. So here there's another term here, Rabbaniyun. Rabbanim, right? Mm-hmm. Rabbanan, really. Rabbanim, Rabbanim.
So he did use it.
Rabbi. They say Rabbaniyun. Yeah, but they don't say Rabbi, heaven forbid. No, that's not good. And there is
an. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Rabban. Yeah. And there's another term that's used here in it, that is Ahbar. What is Ahbar? Not achbar. You Dutch, you don't know the difference between a het and a chaf. Che and ha. You have just che. That's very good.
You want to go down to Limburg. They have a difference.
So, al achbar. Achbar is the plural of haber. Yeah, like in Dutch, haber. Yeah, haber, right? And a haber, a haver in the Talmud, is a scholar. Yeah, but not quite at the level of a rabbi, apparently. So here's a reference to rabbis and haverim here, right? The rabbis and scholars. Pretty cool, huh?
Henry, is that used still in the States as an honorific title?
Haver?
Haver, yeah. You give somebody a haver title. Still happens here.
Nah, not so much. I don't think so, really. Not much. No. I'm really intrigued by your use of calling everybody who comes up to the Torah is a rabbi. Yeah, I think that's really cool. No, you were, but there, I think other people were called up as rabbis. No? You were called up as a rabbi, but that's because you are.
No. If you come up as a rabbi, it's Moreno Arab.
Moreno Arab.
Rabbi is just Mister.
Uh-huh. Reb, like Reb's son. So are you ordained?
Yes.
You guys are all ordained.
Yes.
Yeah. Just accept, yeah. Okay, so now let's read this about the Shekhinah.
Sorry, where is it from?
This is wherever, whenever people engage. This is one you just got out, I think. Oh. It's got it's got a different style of Arabic font on the right.
Whenever people engage.
What day was that originally?
Yeah. Look up.
Yeah. Oh, you had. We found it already.
Yeah.
We took it out.
It's the last one.
Right. Just a different font.
Different font in the Arabic. Okay, so you notice it says transmitted according to a chain of authority, of transmission originating with Abu Huraira on the authority of the Prophet. So this is the very end of that chain of transmission. Mm-hmm. There would probably be another eight, maybe more names in there. And there would be different transmission words, like hadatha or haka, or different words that explain how the data was transmitted by word amount in their presence, or by slightly, and I didn't study this stuff, so I'm not sure, but each verb of transmission has a different sense of it, a sense of the transmission of material, and whichever. And the truth of the matter is that they may have been simply dialectical differences on what word was used for. He said to me, or he told me, or he passed it on to me. But it has come to have meaning on the reliability of the actual material. Right? So this tradition is found in a collection by a guy named Nawawi, because he's from Navav, somewhere in Iran. And this is not in the canonical traditions, in the four canonical traditions.
If he's imam, he would be a Shia.
No, not necessarily. No, not probably not. Imam, this could have just been he was a prayer leader or something. Yeah. There are only 12 imams who are the imams. So imam is used in lots of different ways.
Yes,
so
indeed.
In this particular format, it might be that. No. Some people just get certain titles that are associated with their name. Like, I'm trying to think.
Rabbeinu.
Yeah, Rabbeinu. Yeah. Anyway, I can't remember. Anyway.
Yeah.
Rabban is supposed to something. Anyway, so transmitted according to the chain of a transmission. Said. Could someone read this for me?
Transmitted according to a chain of transmission originating with Abu Huraira, on the authority of the Prophet, who said,
Whatever relieves some worldly anxiety of a believer, God will remove from him one of the anxieties of the day of resurrection. And whoever gladdens someone who is under the stress of poverty, God will gladden him in this world and the hereafter. And whoever protects a Muslim, God will protect him in this world and the hereafter. For God aids the servant who aids his brother. And whoever follows a path seeking knowledge therein, God makes a path to the garden easy for him. No people gather together in one of the houses of God, reciting the book of God and studying it amongst themselves, without the Sakina descending upon them, and mercy envelops them, and the angel surrounds them, and God mentions them among those who are with him. And whoever is slowed down by his actions will not be hastened forward by his lineage.
Do you know what that last one is all about?
Well, I was coming from a poor family, of course.
Well.
So if you're poor, born noble, you
know. It's not going to help you.
No?
Yeah, not going
to help you. Keep working anyway.
Yeah. So that's interesting, right? So no people gather together in one of the houses of God, reciting the book of God and studying the verses without the Sakina descending upon them.
Where's
mercy envelops
them. Where's the fire?
Hmm?
Where's the fire? Well, should be there.
Let's. Well, what does Sakina mean?
Sakina?
Maybe.
Oh. Okay,
so let's take a look at the next page. May I have a reader? I don't care which column you use for this one. On page 2. Oh, you don't have page 2.
ומניין אפילו שלושה שנאמר בקרב אלוהים משפוט ומניין אפילו שניים שנאמר אז נדברו יראי יקוב בעם
I don't know, that's her
איש את ראהו ויקשר השם וישמע ומניין אפילו אחד שנאמר בכל המקום אשר הזכיר את שני יבוא אליך עובר
So those, if you look at those in their context, you see that they refer, or at least the rabbis understood them to refer to different quantities of people gathered together. So, right. So let's read the next one. Stam Shir Shvim.
Stam Shir Shvim, Yish Benehem Divrei Torah, Shchina Benehem, Shemar, Ach Nidberu Yirei Hashem, Ish Et Rehu, Ve'akshev Hashem Ve'ishma, Ve'ikatev Sefer Zikaron Fanav, Yirei Hashem Lach, Ve'chosh Ve'i Shmo. Amy El Shnaim, Minayin Shafil, Achal Shiyoshev, Osek Betarah, Shatavish Baruch Hu, Kovei Lo, Spar, Shemar, Yeshev Badad, Yidon, Kinatah Alav.
Okay. Okay, so Shekhinah, we know what Shekhinah is in Hebrew, right?
Mm-hmm.
Word, from the word Shachan or Shechen, like the dwelling presence or whatever of God.
Shidu Stavim, the neighbors will come and disturb you.
Hmm?
Shidu Stavim, the neighbors will come and disturb you.
I didn't get it. I didn't hear it.
Huh?
What?
Shechen.
Yeah.
When you see the neighbor, the neighbors will come and disturb.
Oh, disturb you. I see. Yes. All right. So so here we have a case a little bit like yesterday when we looked at the story of the sons of Noah.
Mm-hmm.
That you have. When we looked at the Cain and Abel story,
yeah.
And we saw that there was a midrash or a mishnah in that case. This is also sort of it's midrashic, even though it's mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
That was based on text from Torah, and you derive a lesson from that. The Shekhinah is with you, and the Shekhinah is the transplantation, if you will, of some aspect of God, because in all of these contexts that are observed, God is somehow in the picture of when these people are gathered together. Be'adat El, or Yud Hei Vav Hei, or whatever. Yud Kuf Vav Kuf. But you don't have any of that in the Islamic version. It's just a statement, a fact. It didn't need to prove anything, because it was already known. And also because the Quran doesn't say anything about it. Right? So that is evidence that the borrowing comes from a Jewish context into an Islamic context. Because you have authoritative proof text associated with a Jewish context, you don't know literarily, you know, in terms of the kind of literary association, there is none there, that's just kind of a statement. Like it has become a tradition. So it's a tradition that somehow is passed through porous religious cultural boundaries without its proof text. Because the proof text wouldn't make any sense in Islam. Because right. It would be Torah. And Torah doesn't make sense as a proof text in the Islamic context.
That's what my question would be. This is a reference to these texts. Is there any sort of idea about to what time the people who would read this would know that this referencing to another proof text?
Oh, if you were to ask a Muslim today, they would have no clue.
No.
No, not at all. So, and
not
this
even about Bible, because I met Muslims who didn't even know about
sure. The
stories that they
right.
You know?
Yeah. So with this guy, Imam Nawawi, who lived in the 13th century, maybe he knew, maybe he studied with Jews, maybe it was a tradition that he knew about. He's not going to say, I got this from the Jews, or I was studying the Beit Midrash. Right? He's not going to say that. So he's just going to give there's some kind of he's taking it for granted that this is simply a truth, and it's embedded in a whole bunch of other little aphorisms, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Whoever relieves some worldly anxiety of a believer, then God will relieve his anxiety on the day of resurrection. And these are just kind of proofs. These are aphorisms. Whoever does this, whoever does that, and this one sort of creeps in too. So. He may not have had any clue where it came from either. It may have already just been an old tradition.
But was there in the beginning of Islam a general sort of knowledge that there was a reference to Torah stories or to
yes.
Christian stories?
Yes.
And was it suppressed, this knowledge? Or was it just petering out?
Yeah.
Or
that's a very good question, and I have to tell you, I have to give you an answer that's not going to be a quick answer, but it'll be an answer with some stories to it, so hopefully you won't be too bored. Mm-hmm. The Quran, it says, if you have a question about what I say, go to the people of the Dhikr and find out.
Dhikr. Yeah.
So, people of memory, or okay. People who know, or something like that. So what does that mean? We don't know exactly what it means, but some people think that it means you go to the Jews, because they know. And there is another reference in the Quran that says something similar to that, like the people of the book are wise and they know answers, something like that. There are a couple of references in the Torah, in the Quran, that suggest that you should go to the... In the Hadith, which is... remember, is canonized 150 years after the death of Muhammad, there are also some interesting statements that say, Hadithu anu ana bani Israel. Hadith. Recite traditions from the Bnei Israel. Wala haraja. And don't hold back. That's associated with the Prophet. Says that. And then there's some other material in the Hadith that says, why are you going to the people of Israel when all of your answers are clear to you? Don't go to them. So this is 100 years after the death of the Prophet, and you can assume maybe the Prophet said one of them, but he didn't say both of them. Or maybe he was in a different mood at a different time of day, who knows. What it probably reflects is different positions in the Muslim community, reflecting maybe the positions of different factions in the community. Some felt that you can talk to the Jews and learn from them, And some said, you really shouldn't wear an independent religious tradition and don't learn from the Jews because they will distort the traditions or they will throw you off, or we don't need them. We are an independent group. Right, so that's some evidence. Right? Here's another chapter two, a different story. There is a genre of literature in early Islamic tradition that is called Israeliyat. Israeliyat. Right? These are Israelite stories. And the Israeliyat are, that term seems to have gone through a transition of meaning. In the earlier period, that term meant Midrashim, really from the Jews. And it has no value judgment on the term. It's not negative, it's not positive, it's just data, it's information, tradition from the Jews. And some say people were reading Israeliyat, and this isn't one of the Israeliyat that deals with the story of Solomon or David or whoever. So it was just, and people read it, and people looked at it. Later on, in later works, it has a negative connotation, right? So that, and the statements say, don't go and use the Israeliyat. They're a distortion of the divine will, and they don't really get it, so don't use the Israeliyat. Problem is, from the Muslim perspective, is that a lot of so-called Israeliyat had crept into authentic tradition without the label Israeliyat associated with it, and it just got there. And that then became accepted because it wasn't labeled Israeliyat. And other material that was equally valid or invalid from the perspective was associated with the term Israeliyat and then was rejected from the tradition. So, but in some earlier texts, we still have the term Israeliyat being used, and it has no negative connotation. So that, again, suggests that there was a period of time in the early period when Muslims were really going into talking to Jews and learning the traditions from Jews because it made sense that they would do that. Right? And there are even some references to going to the Beit Midrash that is actually called Beit Midrash in Arabic. And I don't remember exactly what the term is, but it has to mean Beit Midrash. And it has to mean with Jews, not with somebody else, in which people studied and they learned. And there's been a fair amount of work on that. It's sort of out now. People don't work on that so much anymore because it's sort of been filtered through pretty much all of those texts. So what do we learn from that? We learn that, or we assume that, in the early period, and this seems to comport with Fred Donner's thesis that the early community didn't think that they were so different from Jews or Christians. There were Muslim believers, Jewish believers, and Christian believers. They're all talking to one another, and that at some point the Muslim believers wanted to, especially because they were the ones in power, as opposed to the Jewish believers or the Christian believers who were under the power of the Muslims, for the most part, that there was a need and an interest in separating from Jews and Christians so that they could have be higher up on the hierarchy and have power over them.
But if maybe you mentioned this yesterday, I don't know all of this yesterday. But if in Surah 5 it says we have brought down Torah, uh-huh, then you would expect that Torah would be, at least Torah, maybe not Tanakh, would be included in the recommended literature.
Right. Except that it also says in the Quran many times that the Jews distorted the Torah.
Okay, so that's where it goes so
the Torah is authentic. The Torah is a true revelation of God. It's not made up.
So it doesn't mean Torah. It looks like it's
Sarah meaning
our Torah. Yeah.
It is Torah, and what we have is also Torah, but we have distorted it over the ages, and so you can't trust it completely. And that also is a great answer to the polemical argument against Islam by Jews who said, that's not real revelation because it's not like our revelation. We have the actual revelation. It's been written down many years ago. It happened at Mount Sinai. We had 600,000 male witnesses. 2 million people were there. So it's absolutely true. and you just have this guy who says he's receiving revelations, and then he's going downtown and talking, on the soapbox. How can you trust that? And this is then saying, well, if there's a discrepancy between what I am saying and what you have, it's because you have distorted the tradition, because God even said so. God told me that you distorted the tradition. So where it conforms, where our traditions conform with one another, that's authentic Torah. Where it conflicts, it's not authentic Torah.
But there's much more than conflicting or non-conflicting Torah. That is also left out in that sense.
This is
Torah.
Okay.
This beginning of giving the chain of transmission,
yeah.
Is that typical for Hadith or Sunnah? Or is it also in the earlier Arabic tradition?
It is. You did say it wasn't as compulsive as in the Hadith. That is where it really has become an art. Uh-huh. But you did have to give a tradition in the name of the person that you heard it from. It's like
because
Shemimah.
It's like the beginning of Avot.
Yeah.
Which I understood was added later.
Yeah.
I think in the 8th or 9th century.
That's
so
what
I'm wondering
too.
If it's taken from Hadith.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Line of transmission,
yeah.
As the beginning.
No, well, I didn't hear that it was 8th of the 5th. What was 8th of the 9th century?
No, only the beginning. Only the first part of the book.
Oh, I thought that it was post-Mishnah, but not post-Gemara. I haven't heard that it was that late. I thought it was like 4th century, 3rd or 4th century, but not...
I remember.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd like to know. Could you tell if you find out when you can send it to me?
Yeah,
if you can. So, if that's the case, then maybe. Maybe. Or, you know, in some of these cases, there's no borrowing at all. It's a common tradition, a common cultural expectation. Yeah. So I know it's time to. Everyone is exhausted. Mm-hmm. Sakina. What is Sakina? Sakina means two different things in Arabic. Sakina occurs in the Quran, and sakana means, has a same root as shachin, which means to dwell. So you could say, if you in modern Arabic, you say ana sakin. I live here, right? This is where I live. It's where I dwell. But it also means quiet and calm.
Sakana or shachina?
Sakana.
Sakana.
Yeah.
Quiet
or calm. And there are fascinating stories about Abraham and the Sakina. When Abraham... No, this is in a different genre, in the Israeliyat. In the Qisas al-Anbiyat literature, it's called the Stories of the Prophets. Literature, which is the equivalent of Midrash. These are narrative stories that elucidate Quranic characters and biblical characters, and even biblical characters that don't occur in the Quran are explained and discussed in that Midrash, which says something very interesting. It suggests that the Muslims couldn't, you know, remember that the Torah is not considered accurate scripture in Islam, as opposed to Christianity considers the Old Testament accurate, just misunderstood or superseded. But in Islam, the Torah is not accurate, so you can't rely on it. And yet, there is a lot of stories in this Midrashic literature which deals with stories in the Torah or in the Tanakh that don't occur at all, not referenced at all in the Quran, which means, suggests that they were interested in it, they were reading it. You can't get rid of the Jews, right? They're just the ancient nature and the stick-to-itiveness of Jewish identity is very powerful, and it really bothers people. And it's just for the same reason that, you know, we're fascinated, or at least some of us are fascinated by things like dinosaurs and cavemen and people like that. There's something about knowing that we are sort of not there or there, they, something about us. And we are really living...
living dinosaurs.
We are living dinosaurs.
You said sakana?
Yeah, oh, so, yeah, sakana.
Sakana can mean to dwell or quiet?
Or to be quiet.
Or to be quiet.
So or quiet or tranquility.
Mm-hmm.
Sakana.
So, and sakina, is that a different form?
Sakina is...
a noun made of this.
Yeah, made of one or both or of them. They have, you know, sometimes you have the same root that has two different meanings.
Yeah.
And that's one of those cases. Yeah. So, I don't remember it anymore. So, Abraham is commanded by God to go raise up the foundations of the house, al-bayt, and that's the Kaaba in Mecca, right? And he needs to go down to Mecca and to do that. And so he needs a guide to take him down to Mecca. And there are a couple of different transcendent guides, depending on which version of the story that you read. One of them is a cloud in the desert. You know, there are no clouds in the desert. It's clear and bright, and the cloud starts moving. So he follows the cloud, and the cloud takes him down to Mecca and sort of hovers over the location where the Kaaba is supposed to be built, and he builds it there. But there's another series of stories about the Sakina that comes and guides him. And it's very interesting. So what is the Sakina? There are different versions of the story, but there's some really amazing images. One is of a huge worm, like a Dune worm from Dune. Did you ever read the book Dune?
Yeah.
You know, those big, huge worms. And it travels on the desert, and it has the head of a cat. And in some versions it has two heads of a cat. And it travels in the desert, and it's long and big and windy, like a kind of a dragon kind of thing. And he follows the Sakina that takes him down to Mecca, and it curls up on the foundations of the Kaaba. And then Abraham and Ishmael dig underneath the shadow of where it curls up, and they find the old foundations of the original Kaaba, and then they rebuild the Kaaba according to the verse of the Quran that says that Abraham and Ishmael raised up the foundations of the Kaaba. So there is the Sakina up here in an interesting guise. I wonder where that comes from. I mean, that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe a desert creature from, who knows what, an old Arabian desert creature that's mixed with a Jewish. Anyway, what?
Well, where does our, because I think that's only Midrash. The Akedat place, the place where later the temple is built.
Yeah, but there's a reference to Moriah as being there in Chronicles.
Okay.
Chronicles says, Solomon building the temple on at Moriah.
Oh,
yeah. So that seems to be.
But the book says also a different word, something like Shtia.
Eben Hashtia. Eben Shtia. Yeah. That's a foundation of stone. That doesn't occur in the Tanakh. That occurs only in the Mishnah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is the foundation stone of the universe. And then there is a later references that say that that's a stone, and then there's something in Nach that talks about something about Jerusalem, the Harim Misavivla, or something like that, and it's associated with that.
Yeah, but it seems to be related to the foundations of the.
Yeah, but that's what Jacob said, you know, the ladder.
No.
It's the same place.
Yeah, in some Midrash.
Oh,
yeah.
Same place.
Okay. So, yeah, but I mean, in the Quran, you said it was it?
No, it was in the Israeli. Yeah.
It is the foundations of the Kaaba.
Oh no! In the Quran, it is says the foundations of the Kaaba. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But these are very old or very familiar mystical experiences, seeing the foundations of the world or of places.
What is then the stone?
It's really building in your own system as a, something, as an experience that you can have, mystical experience that you can have.
There is a tradition that also is post-Quranic. It's very clear. Abraham and Ishmael raised up the foundations of the Kaaba. And the construction is odd. They didn't build the Kaaba. They raised the foundations of the Kaaba, suggesting that there were foundations there and they kind of raised them up.
Yeah.
Or built on them.
You find that in the mystical traditions, you can see or experience the foundations.
Which mystical traditions? And which foundations? Or just in general, generically?
Yeah. Well, you have them in the Psalms also.
Yeah. It's a very common experience to see the foundations of the world, or
and that's an old, very an old Near Eastern
what you're
tradition too.
Is that they share
similar spiritual experience of seeing or experience the foundations.
So there is a post-Quranic Islamic tradition that Beit al-Ma'mur means the house of the Amr. Amr is also to is kind of civilization or another form of kind of dwelling or building. Omara can mean a building in modern Arabic. And the Beit al-Ma'mur is in heaven, and that's the original temple for God. And exactly beneath it, on earth, is the Kaaba. And the Kaaba was first built by Adam, when Adam and Eve in the Quranic version of the story, they both are equal, and they both were equally guilty, and they both were equally exiled, and they were brought down. That's the term that's used, habata. And coming down meant, now in the tradition literature, that's in the Quran, what I just said. In the tradition literature, Adam, then Eve isn't so important at this point. Adam has his feet on earth, and he's so big, his head is in the heavens.
It's in the Midrash too.
Is it?
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think I remember. I mean, not that I would question, but yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah.
So he was brought down to size after he walked across India, because he was brought down in India in this tradition, and he walked all the way to Arabia. Very interesting, because you know there are a lot of Indian Hindu traditions about the gods being brought down from heaven, and that's the location of sacred sites in India. I wonder if there's some... That's interesting. I haven't thought about that. Anyway, he goes to Mecca, which is exactly in the shadow, if you will, of Beit al-Ma'mur, and he builds the Kaaba, the original Kaaba. But then the flood comes. And in order not to desecrate the house of God, God raises up the Kaaba into this Beit al-Ma'mur, which is right above it.
Uh-huh.
And it's there. So the foundations are still there, but nothing else is there. And that's the thing upon which Abraham raises up the foundations. So to make a short story even longer, there are two foundational places in Islam. There is the Kaaba that goes to heaven, and Jerusalem that goes to heaven. And they are kind of contradictory. Because you have one set of traditions that has this, what I just told you about the Beit al-Ma'mur and Adam and all this, and it's right directly under the heavenly house. And then you have the Jewish and Christian tradition where Jesus rises from Mount of Olives, which is Jerusalem, and the temples that sit there, and the Gay Hinnom and all that is right there. And they buy into that tradition too, because that's where Muhammad makes the ascension up to God. And on the end of days, one tradition that kind of brings it all together says that Mecca will come to Jerusalem in the end of days, and they will marry. And on that day will be the day of judgment and the day in which the righteous shall all be revived and go to heaven. Isn't that interesting?
I'm sorry, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
They're getting married.
Yeah.
I'm reading a book about archaeology. And they turn it upside down. They say that people have their spiritual experience first, then they start building the universe with the pyramids and all that sort of stuff. And then civilization starts because people come there and they find out that they can grow food for the people that come there.
Oh, so it's the religious experience that begins civilization.
Yeah, it's exactly the other way around. But they also start with building pillars and stones and all that sort of stuff.
That's very interesting.
Just kind of say it starts with consciousness, and uh-huh. then it starts with religious places, and then because people come there, they need food, and then they start as culture.
And this is in Turkey, isn't it? They talk
it's
about Turkey.
In Turkey, but also in Germany and in France
That sort of weakens it for me, because I don't think Germany and France did that stuff. But Turkey was where these things were really happening.
Also, yeah. But
really?
We can bring in the books tomorrow.
Yeah, okay.
Can we close?
Yeah.
Thank you.